Good morning, all. The first case scheduled for argument is Primatech versus Clerks Plastic. Mr. Lucco.
May it please the court. I'm Bill Lucco. I'm here with Deborah Zahalski on behalf of Primatech 2. The nature of this case involves violations of a court order, settlement agreement, and incorporated licenses, all regarding the manufacture and sale of plant covers. The issues in this case, I think, distill to one: was the court clearly in error in not finding contempt or breaches? And did the court err in not awarding relief? I'd like to direct the court's attention to statements made by the trial court which demonstrate the court's misapprehension of the actual harm that Clerks' conduct caused PT2's, Primatech's, economic interests.
As you go through this, I hope you'll keep one thing in mind that concerns me about your case.
Yes, sir.
As I read your briefs, I had the sense that you were making a jury argument. And of course, our interest in the case is whether there's been an error of law. So I hope that you'll keep that in mind as you go through this, as pointing out to us how there's something wrong with this case that we, as an appellate court, can help you with.
All right. I will do so. I believe that these comments I'm going to reference here demonstrate the court's misapprehension of the harm that was actually caused to Primatech's economic interest by Clerks' conduct, and more importantly, the court's misapprehension of its own broad powers to remedy that harm. And let me direct your attention to, or you'll recall from the briefs, no doubt, on the record. On several occasions, the trial court made reference and utilized statements in its finding and its comments to the effect of paid royalties. They paid royalties on whether they were the sales of the licensed products or unlicensed products. And so you, Primatech, received your royalties, and you're in the business of royalties. So you didn't suffer any damage. And I believe that those statements, which are several places in the court's memorandum and order, indicate that the court did not appreciate what damages there could be other than just royalties. The second area where I think the court misapprehended and gives this court an opportunity to grant relief is in the notion of the remedies in the court's own discretion. And I'll direct your honors to the record, and I'll quote from the court. And interesting comments that were made to counsel at the close of the case. It occurs to me, as I sit here, that really this is an all-or-nothing show because you have not proved damages. Instead, you have proved unjust enrichment. The measure of damages is entirely different than the recovery for unjust enrichment. And I can't award unjust enrichment when there is a contractual remedy. So it looks to me like this is an all-or-nothing case. A few moments later, in addressing defense counsel in closing, he says, I know what you're going to tell me, is that the plaintiff here has proved up a case of unjust enrichment. But under the court's contempt powers, I'm not authorized to do that because I'm only authorized to remediate and give them what they've lost. Now let me come back to the first, what I believe is the misapprehension by the court as to the harm of these errors. Primatech is not just damaged because it gets paid its royalties or it doesn't get paid its royalties. Royalties are not alone the measure of the economic harm that an entity like Primatech can suffer. These kinds of businesses are concerned with more than just royalties. There's the right to grant these licenses of its products, different products to different licensees, to different territories, to sell to differing customers. And all of those rights that are, if you will, reserved, when they're not granted, have economic substance to them. And to allow a party to just take a license and exceed that, then that party is allowed to dictate, if you will, the commercial realities of Primatech's business. If you're given the right to sell a product in Canada with a certain royalty, and you sell that product or a different unlicensed product. Depends on how to what extent you fully breach this. And you sell it in Venezuela. And you say, okay, well, I paid you the royalty that we negotiated for Canada. So what's your complaint? That seems to be what the court focused on. As if the burden should somehow get shifted to the licensor to now come in and prove, well, at that time in Venezuela, we think we could have gotten a higher royalty than what we negotiated in Canada. And the court said, because you arguably didn't prove those kinds of damages, you're out.
With your example, if they were selling Venezuela instead of Canada,
yes, sir,
would that mean they overrode someone else's license in Venezuela?
We don't know that.
Well, sure you do. Your company has a license. It issues licenses for different
I perhaps should
markets.
Have used Venezuela, but let's assume we had the right to license in Venezuela. They would have either overrode that license or they would have arguably affected the market for that licensing power, because now they're doing something potentially in competition with someone else we have licensed or could have licensed.
And that's what you'd be having to show, wouldn't it be?
I believe that is the economic harm that flows from them being able to do what they did. And furthermore, of course...
Is that what you presented to the court?
Yes, sir.
So you showed where that overlap had occurred in lost sales or...
No, I think there's an argument. I think the court did find that we did not prove damages as a result of that. We didn't prove lost sales or lost income. I think the court's wrong. Because there was testimony by Primatech that in those instances, though it would be conjecture and speculation to say what the licenses precisely would have provided in terms of compensation, they would have had license fees, they would have had technology fees, and they would have had something in addition to just royalties. And what in essence happens here is it allows clerks to have negotiated in advance our relationship. They've decided what we're going to pay. Or they've at least tried to cover themselves by saying, well, I'm going to marginalize this because I'm going to have paid you the agreed to royalty, and at least I will have minimized, but I'm unjustly enriching myself. And I point out that these licenses have not only the economic power, if you will, and opportunity and ability to create gain and sales and royalties and other markets, other products and with other customers and so forth, depending on but they also affect market share, marketability, quality control, intellectual property control, things that we as licensors of our intellectual property are keenly interested in that go well beyond strictly the payment of royalties.
So what should the court have done?
Well, I think the court should have found contempt. There's admitted breaches here that are sufficient, and I'll discuss other conduct. I think the court should have found contempt. But let me read to you, if I may, the second part of this economic harm issue and remedy issue where I think the court went astray, and maybe, Your Honor, this will answer your question. He says, I'm not authorized to do that. I know you're going to tell me they proved unjust enrichment. I'm not authorized to do that. I can only remediate what they've lost. I think it's profound that the court said twice they've proved unjust enrichment. And then he says this is an all-or-nothing proposition because he says, look, we're here on contempt. And that's what I believe he thinks at the end game is the all-or-nothing because contract, you've not proved actual contract damages. Loss of sales, loss of income. I would say he ignored the kind of damages I've just described to you, including the testified technology fee, license fees, and so forth, in addition to royalties. But that aside, he says you've not proved damages, so in essence, I can't deal with that. Then he says, but you have proved unjust enrichment. But these parties have a contract, so I can't award unjust enrichment. We were seeking at the trial disgorgement of the profits. So you can't award unjust enrichment because there's a contract. Well, if you think that through, one, I believe that's wrong. I don't believe the subject matter of the contract, which is to sell upgrade and standard plant covers in certain areas, is the same subject matter as to sell different unlicensed products somewhere else. So one, I think it doesn't exactly fit the tight model of unjust enrichment denial where you say, well, it's a contract, so I'm not going to give unjust enrichment. But I think it also tells you that the court is thinking unjust enrichment. That means that clerks has done something that's unjust for which they're benefiting to the detriment of Primatech. But I'm stuck. I can't remedy that because I got a contract. And I think the court could remedy that. I think the court could, under the contempt powers, you don't have to show actual loss. But think about it another way where the court is wrong, Your Honors. When he says the unjust enrichment, if he's saying there's wrongful conduct in a way, whether it rises to the level of contempt, it clearly rises to the level of contract violations. He doesn't say, I find contract violations. He never addresses that. Because remember, he says you didn't prove contract damages, so I'm taking contract out of the picture. This is all or nothing, contempt or nothing.
How many contracts are there?
Pardon?
We're talking about lots of contracts.
We're talking about a settlement agreement, if you will, and four licenses, all on the same kinds of products. Now, what he's saying when he says the unjust enrichment is, I find breaches. Well, then you at least have to, this is not what we're asking for, of course, but at least logically, you're in a position where you have to vindicate those rights based upon those breaches. And you at least should have been awarded of nominal damages if you proved there were no damages or you felt that the unjust enrichment proofs of profits I can't deal with because I'm stuck with this contract.
Well, under Illinois law, you can't get nominal damages unless you prove you were damaged.
Yes, but I believe the damage flows from the unjust enrichment. That is the concept that we've been damaged. And as I said earlier, I think the court's wrong about the damages. When they admit to sales, of inside-outside covers and covers outside the area, that's $18,000 or $19,000 worth of sales. Just take that for instance. They've admitted to those. How the court can say we've not been damaged by those sales that are contrary to the court order, and contrary to the licenses, I don't know. I think the court is clearly wrong. And I think they've been unjustly...
Well, in effect, you were arguing lost opportunity, and apparently the court didn't think that you proved lost opportunity.
Perhaps, Your Honor. The court came down to this as an all-or-nothing transaction. I think it's because he misapprehended that even under his contempt powers, we didn't have to show actual loss. Lost opportunity, lost ability would be enough for him to exercise his powers to try to remedy the situation. Instead, he went with this, you got paid royalties. You're in the royalty business. I'm not going to think further about the damages. I'm not going to think further about unjust enrichment because you had a contract. He should have thought further. The subject matter must be different. If not, Your Honor, it's a classic unjust enrichment where what you have for the conduct that's not permitted, it's like now we have to imply a contract. And now we don't know the terms because the parties didn't negotiate them. So how do you remedy that? You award profits under unjust enrichment. I think there's a way to have gotten to this unjust enrichment that the court simply overlooked by the simplified view of thinking you got a contract. I find this unjust enrichment, but there's nothing I can do about it. That's what I mean when I say I think the court misapprehended the broad powers that it had to remedy the situation that we believe the proof is clear and convincing, but even with the admissions and even with the court's own, I believe, profound statements about unjust enrichment. So I think the court should have remedied this. The court could have determined that there was contempt. And let me segue just briefly into issues of the contempt and their violations. Clerks admitted to selling pot covers that they were called inside out. They were licensed to sell pot covers that are solid on the outside and solid on the inside, varying colors. They were also licensed to sell what are called upgrade plant covers, which are printed on the outside, a printed pattern,
and solid on the inside. And they were selling the reverse of that. And they were selling also plant covers outside the geographic areas. They admitted to those. Once there is that admission, you can get into, does it rise at a level of contempt? And the court found it did not. I think the court was wrong. But there's clear violations. I believe that the evidence is it is contempt. But you have those violations that are not remedied at all. Then you have, I'm going to give you two other examples with the time here. They sold to garden centers. And I believe that the language of the license is clear. Garden centers are excluded customers. This becomes a large issue at the trial because they get into a big argument about whether we proved that everyone acknowledged we were selling to garden centers. I think that's about $18,000 worth of sales. But the defense became, yes, but those garden centers, you didn't prove that they did or did not have horticultural growing operations with them. And so we think they're not excluded customers. And let me read to your honors the language from the license. You can't sell to excluded customers. And excluded customers are defined. Excluded customers means any customer, these are my fingers, it's not written here, but any customer who is not a horticultural grower of potted plants or a retail food supermarket. It goes on. Excluded customers specifically includes, but not by way of limitation, businesses such as, and now we have a litany of these, one of which is garden centers. The defense was, well, you proved garden centers, but you didn't prove whether they had growing operations. And the step of the analysis is they have to not be a horticultural grower. So unless you've proved they're not a horticultural grower, they can't be a garden center. And I think that defies the common construction of this language. I think it's clear that excluded customers are three things: not horticultural growers, not retail food supermarkets, and not the specified list.
You Mr. Lucco, and you're in your rebuttal time, so you want to
thank you.
Just remind you about that.
Thank you.
Do you question Judge Murphy's conclusion that the quantity of non-conforming pot covers sold is a fraction of 1% of the total pot cover sales by clerks?
I do. I believe it's vastly greater than that. I think we proved vastly greater than that. But if you take the admitted sales, and if you take the ones that the garden centers, and I would get to lace if I had the opportunity, I would talk about lace covers that were not permitted, you would get yourself up to a little bit more than 2%. And one could say that's not material, and that was said. But 2% of millions of dollars is, in fact, significant. I mean, in this day and age of shrinking markets and competition, I think the margins are made sometimes on a percent. So I do think the judge was wrong about that, or he drew the wrong conclusions, Your Honor, from that fact. I will save some time for rebuttal. I hope I've answered your questions. I think the court was wrong in its misapprehension, and that clouded how it determined the conduct, the consequences of the conduct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lucco. Mr. Adams?
Thank you. Your Honor, we're not here today because of any mistake that Judge Murphy made at trial. The transcript demonstrates over and over again that he was quite aware that this case would be here today because he was familiar with the parties and the litigation and the case before him. After all, this case starts with a two-day bench trial in March of 2001 in which Judge Murphy decided whether or not to enter the April 5th, 2001 order. And we know that he decided at that trial that the parties had in fact reached a settlement of a case that had been filed that summer of 2000, and entered then the order and the settlement agreement and the license agreements. And then within 5 months of the date of that order, Judge Murphy is ruling on a motion, or Judge Murphy has received a motion for the PT2 to conduct post-judgment discovery. He handles the limited, not vast, but limited pretrial proceedings in that case, and then conducts a 5-day bench trial to decide whether his order had been violated. Judge Murphy is not unusual as a federal judge in this respect. He's not about to let his order get violated. And I think that under these circumstances, a great deal of deference ought to be accorded to the trial judge, and indeed, the law suggests that's the case for good reasons. Not only is he the judge that enters this order, but he is the judge that hears the live testimony, reviews the exhibits in the context of the testimony with the assistance of the parties and the witnesses to answer any question he has. This was not a jury trial. It was a bench trial. And you can see from the transcript that any time he had any question about a contention of the party or an issue of fact, he asked the witnesses and he asked the parties to explain what their contention was so that he made sure he understood the facts. So without question, this was a trial judge who was intent on unraveling the contentions and intent on making sure that he got it correct. And after all of that, he entered an extremely thorough order with citations back to the record evidence that he relied upon for his findings of fact. The plaintiff cannot cite to a single finding of fact, which is clearly erroneous under the relevant standards of this court. And I'll discuss the issue of damages because that was the main focus of PT2's discussion, but candidly, the plaintiff cannot cite to a single case which shows that Judge Murphy made a legal error when he applied the facts that he found to determine the outcome of the case. And it's important to separate this case into the two components, as I'm sure you understand, that exist. We have a contempt case which has the clear and convincing evidence standard, which there is a burden of proof of not only of the violation of the court order, but lack of reasonable diligence and significance. And again, Judge Murphy made extensive findings of the reasonable diligence of clerks to comply with his order. The plaintiff can disagree with those findings, but the plaintiff cannot show that those findings are clearly erroneous. So contempt goes out the window on that basis alone. There are many bases which it can go out, but it goes out on that basis alone. With respect to breach of contract, this court held in the TAS distribution case of last year that under Illinois law, an essential element of any breach of contract claim is evidence of harm or of damages. That's clear under Illinois law, and that's a 2007 opinion. So when we talk about damages, and we talk about the cases which discuss damages, we have to remember that the plaintiff had the burden of proving that it was harmed. Judge Murphy, throughout the transcript, reminded the plaintiff of the case that it was presenting. This plaintiff was trying to ring the bell or hit a home run, so to speak. It made a conscious decision to present as its damages theory only evidence of the gross proceeds of the sales of the products that it contended violated the license agreement. It did not present any evidence of the nature that Mr. Luco just discussed, that somehow its market was harmed, its reputation was harmed, it had lost some other profits. It was asked in discovery and refused to provide evidence in discovery and chose not to present any evidence at trial that the royalties that it received from the allegedly violating sales were any less than the royalties it received from its other licensees who, I believe the testimony is, had licenses to make every one and all of these products. So we have a complete failure of proof of any harm of an intangible nature, which Mr. Luco described, and we have a complete failure of proof of financial harm.
Was there any evidence of what percentage of overall sales for Primatech that clerks represented?
No. No, we tried to find that information, but there was not. At best, and I'm not uncertain of this, Your Honor, at best, there was evidence that Clerks was not the majority of Primatech sales. But we believe that Clerks was one of the two most significant licensees. I don't know how much of that made it into the record.
Of course, now they're completely out.
Correct. They have been out since June of 2002 when the first contempt motion was filed. That business is over, so contempt was never needed for coercive purposes. The whole issue with respect to the failure to prove damages is that there are contempt cases which have been cited in all the briefs, in which the courts have found that the defendant's profits serve as a proxy for the plaintiff's damages. And the two cases that are of most significance are the Connolly case, which was decided by this court, and the Lehman case decided by the Supreme Court. And I think it's important to understand that there are three pretty important differences between those two cases and this case is on the issue of whether profits can serve as a proxy for damages. First, in each of those cases, of course, there was proof of contempt, which is lacking here. We'll put that aside. Second, in each of those cases, the court was upholding the discretion of the district court to award profits to the plaintiff. There's no case that I'm aware of that has been cited and that I'm aware of otherwise in which a court has held that the district court abused its discretion by choosing not to use the defendant's profits or the defendant's sales as a proxy for the plaintiff's damages. And then third, and perhaps even most importantly, in both Lehman and in Connolly, the defendant's profits were an element of damages that would have been awardable to the plaintiff outside of the contempt proceeding. In Connolly, it was a copyright infringement case, and the district and in the recitation of what the district court did, it's clear that the district judge said, "Well, look, if this was just a copyright infringement case, I could award the plaintiff the defendant's profits, and so I'm going to do that as a measure for contempt." And the Seventh Circuit found that to be appropriate. The Lehman case was a patent infringement case, so it's obviously much more relevant to this case, but the important fact about the Lehman case is that it was decided in 1932 at a period of time in which the defendant's profits were awardable to a plaintiff in a patent infringement case. That law was changed in 1946 and 1952. Now in a patent infringement case, the recovery for the plaintiff is either the plaintiff's lost profits or a reasonable royalty rate. And in fact, PT2 cited in its reply brief the Panduit case out of the Sixth Circuit, which is a contempt case, and the whole issue was, I'm sorry, I don't believe that was a contempt case. I think that's just a pure patent infringement case. I'm not sure. But the issue was whether or not the district court had properly determined the reasonable royalty rate to award the plaintiff. Well, in this case, the plaintiff did not present any evidence of that. The law of Illinois, and I believe the federal law of contempt is very clear, that the plaintiff had the burden of proving the fact of harm. In other words, fact of harm, even after Connolly, is still a requirement. Connolly distinguishes the United Mine Workers case in Lehman, and I believe that the fact that it was harm still must be shown, and then the plaintiff must offer some reasonable basis to award either damages under breach of contract or contempt recovery. The plaintiff chose not to do that. It went for gross sales, and gross sales are not an appropriate method of recovery in this case. Your Honor, just as a point of contention, I believe Mr. Luco stated that the defendant admitted to selling to garden centers. I don't think that that's correct in the record. There were clearly a number of customers whose name included garden center or something to the like. We don't dispute the evidence of what sales were made, but I don't think there was any admission that those businesses constituted a garden center under the terms of the license. Otherwise, Your Honor, we have attempted to thoroughly make our arguments in our brief. I'm delighted to answer any question you have about the contentions that we make.
All right. Guess not. Thank you, Mr. Adams. Mr. Luco?
Thank you again. Very briefly, obviously, when Mr. Adams says we can't point to one finding that is clearly erroneous, well, the finding that they didn't violate the licenses is clearly erroneous. We know they did. They admitted doing so. Secondly, there's a finding in this case. I'm not sure how it ultimately played out in the decision of the court, but there's a number of findings about we never transferred technology to them. Well, the license agreements themselves contained the signed parties' acknowledgement that we transferred technology to them. They acknowledge the receipt of it and the transfer of it and the substantial benefit it gives them in making these products. That is contained in the license documents. How the court says it's not being transferred in light of that, I think, is clearly erroneous. The garden centers, I think, is clearly erroneous. The selling of lace pot covers, I think, is clearly erroneous. They are printed on the inside, not on the outside. Finally, Your Honor, he talks about the plaintiffs and trial court, the trial down below, where they tried to hit a home run, I believe Mr. Adams said, by seeking gross proceeds. That's true. They did do that. Trial counsel did do that. But there's evidence in the case, hard evidence produced by the defendant among themselves, of what actually they called contribution margin, what the profits were for the allegations we were making, and that's in excess of $900,000 in profits, not gross proceeds. That is in the record and the testimony of their expert, Mr. Seifert. And lastly, he said that profits would not be an available remedy in a case like this. Well, I think that gets me back to the court's finding, the court's declarations of will twice that we proved down below unjust enrichment. And profits are appropriately awarded in the unjust enrichment case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Luco. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.